Welcome to Upthinking Finance, a podcast that offers a unique and discerning view of economics and financial planning. Here is your host, Emerson Fersh.
Welcome back to another edition of Upthinking Finance. I'm Emerson Fersh. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan once said, "If I turn out to be particularly clear, you've probably misunderstood what I've said." Now, if there's one area that's been in news consistently for the last 2.5 years related to economics and finance, it's been inflation and the direction of interest rates. And confusing is probably an understatement in terms of trying to figure out exactly what's going on. However, today's guest is going to shed some light on this. I'm going to be talking Fed today with Kevin Flanagan. He serves as the head of fixed income strategy for WisdomTree Investments, where he provides expertise on WisdomTree's existing and future bond ETFs. He also publishes regular written commentary, which is available to the public, and records a fixed income-related podcast called Basis Points. And I got to say, if there was ever a cooler name for a bond podcast, I don't know what it is. Basis Points. Anyway, prior to joining WisdomTree, Kevin spent 30 years at Morgan Stanley, where he was the managing director and chief fixed income strategist for the wealth management division. There, he was responsible for both tactical and strategic recommendations and created asset allocation models for fixed income securities. He was a contributor to the Morgan Stanley Wealth Management Global Investment Committee and also the primary author of both the monthly and weekly fixed income publications. Kevin has an MBA from Pace University's Lubin Graduate School of Business and a BS in finance from Fairfield University. So it's my pleasure to welcome, coming to us from the greater New York metropolitan area, which is also known as Connecticut, my friend Kevin Flanagan. Kevin, thank you for joining me on Upthinking Finance.
Thanks, Emerson. Great to be here.
No, I appreciate it. So I guess first thing, 30 years in the fixed income business, I'm thinking, okay, you go back to probably the bond market meltdown of 94, maybe before that. Maybe just give us kind of a snapshot of what your career has been like and sort of what's happened and what's changed over the years.
Well, I think the most fascinating thing is just to have watched the evolution of interest rates and how advisors and investors respond. So prior to the financial crisis, we seemed to be thinking of what was out of the realm of normal rates was when we were double digit during the Volcker era. And then we kind of nestled into this 3-5% kind of range. I'm talking about treasuries, just to keep it simple. And then from 2010 to 2020, we experienced zero rates, negative rates. And what was interesting about that is as we've come out of that, a lot of investors tended to think, well, we're going to go back there. And that's not my opinion. I would say that the 2010 to 2020 period was abnormal. And what we're experiencing now is we're going back to a little bit more normalcy with respect to rate levels and where they typically are. And it's interesting because you've even had Fed Chairman Powell acknowledging it's highly unlikely that we're going to return to the pre-COVID or COVID kind of levels of interest rates. The one other thing that I would mention is volatility. Volatility in the bond market, at least let's call it the treasury market, at the levels we've witnessed over the last few years is historical in nature. And I think a lot of it had to do with some of this uncertainty, trying to get used to this new rate regime, what I like to call it. It's actually a new old rate regime per se. So you have a whole generation of advisors and investors who almost have to be re-educated to this. It's funny. I've done some things in the public and I ask people, people say interest rates are back to where they were 15, 16, 17 years ago. The Fed funds rate is essentially at a 20-year high watermark. And I'll go, just show of hands by the audience. Tell me 15 to 20 years ago, were you in college? You get a few. Were you in high school? Were you in middle school? Where were you? And I think that's one of the more fascinating parts is just how quickly the evolution in the bond market has moved to volatility. And within that, yield movements that used to take maybe a year to occur now occur in weeks, months, maybe even a day. It depends upon the kind of headlines we're getting.
Gosh, you covered a lot there. And you brought up a really good point. I actually got into the financial services industry in 1986, working at a savings and loan in Southern California. And so I remember the Black Monday. I remember people coming in with the redemption checks. But that was sort of the beginning of the decline in rates, which, as you mentioned, has just been a consistent theme within the financial markets for the last 40 years, really. And so there is an adjustment. So let me ask you this then, because, and I've noticed and I hope this isn't an unfair label, but you seem to be a person, from what I've read and I've listened to, that doesn't follow a narrative. I mean, you're pretty much seeker of truth, I guess I'll say, in terms of what's going on. I mean, which is, I think, a good place to be. You're not married to any kind of an outcome. But is it simply just that that's where we're headed, a new paradigm in that rates are going to continue to go up? Or is it, in your mind, more of a new paradigm where things just sort of settle into more of a what's a normal range, given the broader history than the last, like you said, 10 years?
I call it the new old rate regime. It's the new old rate paradigm, either way that you want to characterize it at this stage of the game. You know, I mean, I will definitely have a stand, but I think the Fed's going to do what I think rates are going to do. But I think what's important, doing this as long as you can, is you need to be humbled by the market. The market is a lot smarter than me, right? I've been doing this 30 years and I'm still learning things every day. And I think that's what needs to be, I think, emphasized, in that if you're wrong, don't explain it away. Say, okay, I didn't get that call right. Okay. And this is why. This is what I think going forward. I think that offers far more credibility when you're speaking, rather than sticking to your guns, a narrative where it's just like you're going down with the ship and it's just, you need to reflect reality of what's really occurring. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because the market was kind of in that narrative heading into this year about Fed rate cuts, right? And now, next thing you know, we've completely turned the market's expectations on its head as to what Fed policy was going to be this year. So that's what I mean. Things can change very quickly. And back to your first question, it's some of this uncertainty and volatility that's more new, I think, to the bond market than when I started 30 years ago. And maybe it has to do with the fact that there's more openness. Remember, 30 years ago, when you had a Fed meeting and the Fed was either raising or lowering rates, they didn't tell you. You had to figure it out based upon their open market operations. I won't go too far down the rabbit hole there, but you didn't have Powell coming out with a policy statement and then a press conference and then dot plots and all of that. You basically just had the Fed meeting happened. Okay, what did they do in the open market operation? So that determined whether or not they kept rates unchanged or they raised them or lowered them. So maybe some of that volatility or uncertainty has to do with more open communication, which arguably, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I think what we have seen is that the more open that the Fed is with their communications, the more open it is for the chance of misinterpretation.
First of all, I appreciate you mentioned the word humble, and that's a word that's come up with a few different analysts and people that we follow, a healthy respect for the unknown. And I think I really appreciate that. And I guess kind of where I sit on this side of the desk working with clients is to continue to rely on, and this is something I observe, I won't put you in that saying that this is something you see from your side, but there just seems to be a lot of people who want to just continue to rely on what's worked. Now, I get these little advertisements in my email every day from, you know, a lot of the usual companies, and it's still the 60-40 portfolio and a lot of these same kind of principles that build on this. And I just think you have to be willing to adapt at some point, because as you said, I mean, I've been hearing this pivot, when the pivot's coming, from, you know, clients for the last 2 years, right? Well, it ain't coming, and I don't think it is coming, but who knows? Maybe it's later, maybe it's sooner, nobody knows. And so I just appreciate that, because I think that to me is the challenge of today. I got to ask you a question that you brought up about the Fed. And I had my CPA friend, Paul, actually mentioned this to me on Friday, and I told him I was going to be speaking with you. But at what point, and he used the word activist, I'm not going to ask you to stick with that, but at what point did the Fed become, from what you said, kind of a behind the scenes determiner of monetary policy versus what he calls an activist, but become almost a bit of a celebrity role, to the point now where I had a, I don't know if you're familiar with Alex Craner, he's over in Monaco, but he mentioned, you know, he's a friend of mine that gives us information. And he said that really the biggest driver for prices of equity markets has been the movement of the Fed. How has that evolved? Because clearly, I mean, everybody's hanging on any word that comes out of not just Powell's mouth, but any one of these governors. I mean, side comment at some university moves the market in a day, like you said.
Us bond guys always like to say rates make the world go round, right? It does start with interest rates. I mean, I'm sure there's earnings and what have you with respect to the equity arena, but the beginning, the benchmark, the underpinning are interest rates. And who sets interest rates in the US, if not almost globally, in a sense? It's the Federal Reserve. So I think, as to use the term again, as things have evolved in the bond market, say over the last 30 years, there was always a clamoring for the Fed to be more open. Some of it actually began on a political front. I remember Greenspan butting heads with a congressman for the chairman of the House Banking Committee or something like that back in the 90s. And so the Fed went through a whole process of what is the best way to try to communicate to the markets. So it has been a deliberate process. It wasn't like we went from the Fed behind the scenes to where we are now. It actually has evolved over the last three decades to where the Fed didn't make an announcement. And now we have a policy statement, we have a press conference, and every other meeting, we have the summary of economic projections. Now, in terms of the Fed speak, what I like to do is cut through some of the noise. And to me, there's three people that you need to be watching when the Fed speaks publicly that will speak on behalf of the Fed, not their personal viewpoint, which is a big difference, but oftentimes can be misinterpreted by the market. Back to that again, the more you speak, the more you could be subject for misinterpretation. So it's the Fed chairman, the Fed vice chairman, and the New York Fed president. Those I call the big three. When they speak, they're speaking more on behalf of the Fed and Fed policy. A Fed governor, a regional bank president, they're going to be speaking more of their own opinions. Now, some presidents or governors will get more attention by the markets, maybe depending upon their track record or something like that, where they may have said a certain thing. Like a perfect example, St. Louis Fed President Bullard, who recently moved, I think, away from being the St. Louis Fed president. He was one the markets used to like to watch. Now, I would say Governor Waller is another kind of vocal Fed speaker that the markets like to watch. But once again, they were never speaking on behalf of the Fed. But what they try to do is glean as much information as we can. And I think to your question, that's what the markets are trying to do. It's trying to get inside baseball a little bit, trying to say, is there anything within that nuanced that we can try to take away from what the Fed's trying to say? And that's sometimes when you can get yourselves into trouble. So going back to Waller, for instance, Waller was viewed as one of the more hawkish FOMC members. Remember, a Fed governor is always going to be a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee. The regional bank presidents rotate every year. So Waller, or a Fed governor, is always going to be a voting member. So he was on the hawkish side as the Fed was raising rates. And back towards the fourth quarter of last year, he started changing his tune, his narrative a little bit. And that gave way. I'm not saying he was the reason why, but it kind of added to the fuel, added to the momentum of the market expecting perhaps a reversal. You used the word pivot and moving towards rate cuts. And that once again, what we're finding out is the market got ahead of itself. So you had a treasury market rally for the ages in the fourth quarter. And I remember writing and podcasting and saying, okay, that's great, but it needs to be validated at some point in time. You can have a 100 basis point move, but the data and or Fed policy needs to validate that. And what we're finding out this year through the first three and a half, four months of the year, the validation never came. Matter of fact, it was just the opposite, that the economy is proving and the labor markets to be far more resilient than what was anticipated, and inflation stuck in the mud, which to me isn't a surprise on the inflation side because, look, far be it from me, I've never run a marathon or anything like that, but I'm told that the last mile is the most difficult part. And that's where I think we are with inflation. It's easy to go from 9% to 3% year over year, but to get from 3% to 2% where the Fed wants to go, that can be a little bit more difficult or tricky. And I think that's what we're finding out right now. So all of a sudden, you have Waller speaking differently than where he was in Q4. I'm not saying hawkish. The Fed still seems to be on the page that rate cuts are a reasonable case scenario for this year. But it just goes back. I mean, you tie it all together. All these things are interrelated and important in terms of Fed communication and what the markets are trying to glean from it.
No, that's great. And that's really helpful, what you said, because I think sometimes one blog I follow, they will literally take the last Powell speech, compare it to the current one, and show where the change. I mean, it strikes me as almost you're looking for something that just isn't there. It's kind of like the thing with, and again, this is my opinion. I love your thought on it, talking about, well, the role of the, because you brought up politics, and I'm sure there's some element of it. But it seems to me, at least to this point, Powell has really resisted the temptation, the pressure, whatever you want to call it, to start lowering rates prematurely. And if there's ever an argument against this, some kind of politically motivated agenda here, that would seem to be it. I mean, the proof is kind of in the pudding, right? Is that a simple way to look at it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've always been of the belief that the Fed understands politics. They know this is an election year. They know how polarizing things have become. But that doesn't mean that they're operating under the assumption that policy needs to be taking politics into consideration. So at this stage of the game, when we came into this year, the Fed was supposed to have started cutting rates in March. Then it was June. Now, if you look at expectations, it's September. Do I think that the Fed is not cutting rates for a political reason here because it's an election year? No, they're not cutting rates because the data has not led them to cut rates. And if the data leads them to cut rates later this year, they will. Now, do they do it right before election day or right after? Maybe that's where they take some of that into consideration. But here's an interesting tidbit. Their November Fed meeting, they're usually Tuesday, Wednesdays, and you get the announcement and the press conference on a Wednesday. The November Fed meeting this year takes place pretty much right along election day. So it's actually, I think, become a Wednesday, Thursday instead of a Tuesday, Wednesday. Now, would the Fed consider cutting rates, if need be, 2 days after the election? Maybe not. Maybe that's where they say, we can wait, we can move in December. But in terms of what they actually do from a broader policy perspective, the Fed's going to do what the data lead them to do. And I think that's where we're at this stage of the game. You know, I mean, you can do a lot of conspiracy theories if you want. And people say, well, if you look back over time, they've never done this, they've never done that. But I would say, well, did you look at what the economic and inflation narrative was at that time as well? Or did you just look at it from the political sphere?
And what you just said, I mean, again, you're much more into this than I am. But what I've heard is the consistent message coming out of the Fed for the last couple of years has been, we're following the data. I mean, that has been a consistent theme in any kind of a press conference. So let's talk about inflation. And I'm going to share with you my, again, non-economic background. See, to me, in my view, that horse is out of the barn because I don't see how too much money in the system is the problem, right? I mean, that's the ultimate cause of inflation. And so at least some of the arguments that have made sense to me was the stimulus to save the economy during the COVID. And so now these are the ramifications of that. I guess I don't understand how longer term inflation goes anywhere but up. So that's a question I'd like you to comment on, because you lower rates, it's just easy credit again, right? And that makes more money, more demand. Maybe that's simplistic. That's one question. And then the other one is, you mentioned in your last write-up, and I'm just asking because I don't know, but why is there an exclusion in some measures of inflation of energy and food? Because to me, that's the one that hits home with everybody. So that's a two-part question for you.
It's a great question. I know when I'm speaking to clients and clients out there, I always start with that. Okay, that the markets will look at core inflation, ex food and energy, but I know we all have to eat, heat our homes, drive cars and things like that. So the feeling is that the exclusion of food and energy is because the Fed has no control over food or energy prices. That's the thought process behind it. What can the Fed control? The Fed's not controlling commodities per se, like food. That could be weather related. Even energy could be weather related or geopolitical related as well, right? From what we're finding out. And that the Fed can stick more to its guns in terms of things in core goods or core services. So I think that's how the market got to that point in time. What I find interesting is that a lot of people have been bending over backwards trying to find out, why is the economy resilient? Why is there still inflation? You mentioned a lot of money floating around. There's still a lot of money floating around. I mean, I know COVID was 3-4 years ago in terms of 2020 and 2021 and the lockdowns, but what did the government do since then? And this is not a political statement from my vantage point. This is me being a fixed income strategist, calling it, you know, the shots, is that the amount of government stimulus that came post COVID was enormous. A lot of people tend to lose sight of that as well. And if you look at the fact that the US is running essentially $2 trillion deficits now, why? Well, because there's tons of government spending occurring out there that moves along as well. So you look at this at the Fed rates, 525 basis points. But in the meantime, you had multi-trillion dollar government spending packages get enacted over the last couple of years. I don't think you can dismiss that as a factor in what we're seeing right now. And once the horse gets out of that barn, it's tough to bring it back in. So I think that's a lot of what we're seeing right now. And to your point as well, the Chairman Powell mentioned that he could consider lowering rates. It doesn't need to get to 2% inflation. They use their own measure, the core PCE deflator. And that runs anywhere from, say, a half to a full percentage point below core CPI. I wrote about this recently. So it made me start thinking, well, say you get to 2.5% on the Fed's measure, but you're 3 to 3.5% on the CPI, which the market tends to watch. I don't know if that would be greeted all that favorably by the bond market in that situation. So the Fed needs to get there. The data needs to take them there. Does Powell seem like he's itching to cut rates? He does. I do feel that, you know, it seems like the Fed wants to cut rates. It's like, show me a reason. Give me a reason so I can cut rates. And if that reason comes, and that would be renewed progress on inflation and perhaps some softening in the labor markets, the Fed will go. The Fed will cut rates this year, once again, regardless of the fact it's a presidential election.
All right. So let me ask you this. Well, maybe the impact of the Fed. And so one of the things, and you brought this up earlier, that it really, the Fed doesn't, you know, their policies impact globally. I mean, we're not just an isolated little island over here. But I've also read, we subscribe to a lot of data because one thing I've learned is you need to get pieces from different people and kind of formulate, discern what feels right for you based on your experience and stuff. And let's take Japan. And they're into this situation, as you know, where they've been keeping rates down, negative interest rates now for quite a while. And I don't know if you're familiar, and you probably are, this financial repression concept that's out there. One economist that we follow talks about sort of phase one and phase two. Phase one is the Bank of Japan buying up, and there's a U.S. tie to all this, Bank of Japan buying up all their bonds to keep rates down. But eventually, they've got to start relying on banks being mandated to do that as well, because there's only so much money, you know, so many bonds you can hold in your portfolio to keep rates down. So my question is, and then of course, Japan, 70% of their assets are held U.S. securities. I think, I don't know, most of it direct, some of it through Cayman accounts. But my question is if foreign governments, and you know, China's a whole other issue, which you could even argue that's a potential risk because of what happened with Russia and sanctions. So I guess this is, I'm going all over the place here, but the short of it would be if foreign governments start dumping their U.S. Treasury holdings, and I know this is like a narrative that or a conversation that's been going on for years, but doesn't that sort of neuter the ability of the Fed to control rates? Because at the end of the day, if the supply starts increasing because these governments are dumping this stuff, do you know what I'm saying? I mean, isn't there some kind of an offset where the Fed can lower rates all they want, but the long end's just going to take off?
I think there's a means of differentiating here that I don't think you're going to see foreign holders dump their treasuries. Will they be buying less? I think that's more or less the way to look at it. So if you're thinking about it, a China or Japan, some of the top two holders of U.S. treasuries, they're not going to begin dumping their holdings. I mean, that's information the markets will be aware of, and it's basically hurting themselves. But when they have maturing issues or redeeming issues, it's kind of like the Fed's balance sheet. It's kind of like quantitative tightening in a sense, that will they be buying the same amount that's maturing? I think maybe there's a case to be made for that. That's the way that I would look at it, that you had zero and negative rates abroad, and that now that you can get some yield, that the cost of hedging has become more difficult to purchase US dollar-based, say, treasuries for foreigners. So I would say something that was a tailwind for rates, say, during 2010, 2020, is no longer with us. And what it does, I think, is act as a floor under where U.S. rates can go. Is it going to be an active force that pushes them higher? I don't know if I come to that conclusion quite yet. What I think you start off with is it serves as a floor, that you don't have that wind at your back anymore, and that you will now see as well, kind of like to what you were saying, is that if we need to finance those $2 trillion deficits that I mentioned just a few minutes ago, right? And if you need to finance those and you're doing it with less help from foreign money, what does that tell you, right? If you were in a Econ 101 or a Market 101 class, that would tell you rates may need to rise to get that done. So that would be the way that I would look at it, that I think when we were talking about higher for longer, that certainly falls into that category.
See, that makes sense to me. I really appreciate that because, again, and that's part of the challenge. I think we all have a bunch of different aspects of life, but particularly economics and just this whole investment climate. you know, there's these extremes, right? There's always these extremes. And that just, what you just said, that makes sense to me. I appreciate that. So let me ask you this then, the elephant in the room question, but you seem like a guy who I can ask these questions to. $35 trillion debt right now that's going up, I've read somewhere $1 trillion every 100 days. I mean, how does that end? I've shared this in a bunch of episodes where people would ask me back in the 90s, you know, when it didn't matter, what about the debt? And I'd be like, well, what about it? It doesn't impact anything. But to me, that's a shift that now all of a sudden with rates having, as you said, gone back to more of a normal range, there's some kind of a displacement. But that's my question. In your opinion, I'm not holding you to this, but how does that end or where does it go or what's the overhang? Because it can't be a non-factor forever.
I mean, it doesn't matter until it does, right? Isn't that the expression that people tend to use?
Yeah.
So you're at the point now where, to your point, even though we're having essentially record-setting auctions on the coupon side of the ledger, they're being underwritten, they're getting done, and I would expect that to continue. I'm not in the camp you're going to have a failed treasury auction. I don't see that happening. But could you get to the point where you may have some sloppy auctions where rates rise a lot more than what the issue was anticipated to come at? That could be something forthcoming down the road, but I don't know how it ends, to be honest with you. I would say, unfortunately, human nature would just tell you something bad has to happen to make it to end, right? That tends to be human nature. Things keep going until something bad happens. And I hope I'm not around for that something bad to happen because I'm not quite sure what it would be. But there is a point, right? You would think there is a point, but I don't know where it is. I'm in your camp. Same thing. People ask me that question all the time, and I don't have an answer for it, to be quite blunt. I don't know. And to me, it would take some type of situation for the government where maybe you do have failed auctions, not just one, like you see a trend where all of a sudden you're not getting it done. But that just doesn't seem like it's something in the near term, in the foreseeable future at this stage of the game. So in terms of debt to GDP, all of that, it is unsustainable. I just don't know what the end game is to reverse it.
No. And again, that's a fair answer because I don't know. I mean, how could anybody know? And I think the responsibility is when you're planning out positioning people is just to allow for the possibility. I think that's the difference, is to be willing to allow for the fact, hey, this is potentially on the table. That's a risk you start considering when you're positioning people out. I mean, to me, I guess the big mistake right now is to ignore those kinds of things. There's a lot of, like you said, it's an outcome. Who knows where it's going to end? But no, I appreciate that.
So, you know, Emerson, real quick, I just wanted to say, it's not as if in recent financial history, we haven't had our fiscal house in order. Under Clinton, once again, this isn't political, but under Clinton, we actually ran some surpluses, believe it or not. And I remember this vividly, where the U.S. government was actually doing a buyback program where they had enough cash in the surplus to begin buying back some of the older debt that had double-digit coupons. It was actually a very prudent fiscal policy at the time. And I remember being asked, well, do you think then that Fannie Mae will become the new benchmark agency paper in the debt arena? And I was like, no, I don't think that. But it's not as if in recent financial or modern financial history, we haven't had a surplus. But right now, if you just look at the political will out there, it just doesn't seem to be moving in that direction. But who knows? Maybe 10 years from now, it will.
Until you said, I remember those days. I mean, surplus. When's the last time you heard that in the same sentence of the government, other than maybe, but no, I remember, you're right. It's like a lifetime ago. So here's a question, and I don't know if this is in your arena, but again, I'm just a few things I wanted to just take the opportunity to ask. I've noticed in the last, I don't know, let's say 2 to 3 years, that the municipal bond market, I don't know how much exposure you have there, has treaded a lot different path than the government's. And in spite of rates going up, municipals have seemed to have done pretty well, generally speaking. And I'm wondering if there's a reason for that, because the only thing I could come up with is it seems like the percentage of whatever the measurement is that measures, you know, spending of municipalities has stayed very stable over the last 20 or 30 years versus, you know, what we were just talking about. But I mean, is there any reason for that? Because it seems like it's a disparity. And I don't know, maybe that's just normal. And I've never really hooked into it before. But
well, I mean, munis are predominantly, I would say, unless you have a credit issue, a rate sensitive arena, right? You would put it in there. But there is credit aspect to it with the different issuers that you have, especially the further down the line you go, getting away from state GOs and things like that. But I think they were flush with cash with COVID and coming out of COVID. So I think from that vantage point, that's certainly been beneficial for the muni market. And another is the inherent buyer. Me in Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, California. You know, if you think about it, the individual tax rates, you look at it from a tax equivalent basis, what makes sense? What should I be buying as a fixed income investor? If you're in the top federal tax bracket and say in California, you're at 13.3%, you probably should be looking at munis as a part of your portfolio from a tax equivalent basis as to what you can earn, depending upon obviously your investment needs, risk parameters and things like that. But if you're looking at it from a balanced portfolio, and the fact if you could buy California paper that you feel is credit worthy and the income involved when you look at it from that tax equivalent basis, it's an inherent buyer. It makes sense. So that's something that that arena has that, you know, a lot of the other debt markets don't necessarily have as an underpinning.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, okay, as we're winding down from where you sit right now, and again, this we're about the middle, actually, tax day, April 2024. If you had to, based on your experience, what you see in the moment, again, allowing for the fact that there's these variables you just don't know are going to come out, where do you expect we're sitting, let's say, 2 years from now? Or is that just too far to look given with everything that's, you know, even with elections and all this stuff? Maybe that's a better question. Scratch that. How far are you willing to look out? What do you foresee if you're to just from your own kind of experience, gut, whatever you want to call it, instinct, where do you think things are headed? Is that a fair question? I don't mean to pin you down, but
I mean, the way the bond market's traded this year, who knows what's going to happen next week, let alone right a year from now. I would say you're probably in a trading range. So let's just look at it from a 10-year treasury yield. I was operating under the assumption, I think we had gotten into a 4 to 4.5% kind of equilibrium, but that you could overshoot that. And I think that's what you're seeing right now. So could the 10-year go back to 4.75 or 5? The data come in a little bit hotter like it has, I wouldn't rule that out. I'm not in the camp you're going to 6% on the 10-year treasury within the next year. So I think what you're doing is you're finding out, how do I figure fair value? Sometimes for us bond guys, it's just math, okay? So you look at real rates, real yields, tip yields, 10-year tip yields around, let's call it 2-ish percent. And say inflation is somewhere around 2.5% or so. That, doing the math, means the 10-year treasury should be at about 4.5%. If you were to look at it now, it should be closer to 5% probably. So I would think that if you were to ask me, is there more of a case that the 10-year stays closer to 4.5% or dips below 4, I would say more likely it stays more anchored to that 4.5-ish kind of range. Could be plus or minus 25 basis points, right? But do I see us going back to below 4, to 3.5, 3.25? I don't foresee that over the next year.
No, that makes sense. This is just a side note, but it's something I'm sure you could educate people on. What's the connection between the 10-year and gold? Because I know I just saw something that all of a sudden they've kind of parted ways. But if you look at like a 20 or 30 year correlation between the two, what's that about?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have a good answer for you on that one. It's not something that I follow all that closely. Oftentimes you look at what's one of the major factors, and that's inflation and or inflation expectations and how gold responds and how, say, a bond would respond. You would think they would be in an inverse kind of correlation in that kind of an environment. I think over time, over a longer period of time, like you said, 20 years, I wouldn't expect that relationship to change. But, you know, over the course of 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, you could certainly have some dislocations that you see, and also geopolitical forces as well. You never know what's going to happen. I mean, God forbid what's going on in the Middle East were to expand into something more dramatic, then you have differences as well where treasuries could be viewed as a safe haven. Perfect example was heading into the weekend, treasury market was rising in yield all week. And then come that Friday, it actually rallied a bit because there were concerns of what Iran would ultimately do with respect to Israel. So that relationship, that safe haven relationship from a geopolitical standpoint, also plays a role, I think, for both gold and treasuries.
One thing I've found in the last 2 to 3 years is that, yeah, there is a need to adapt and look at a changing environment. I mean, I had a gentleman on with Resolve Asset Management probably a year ago, and he just talked about growing up in South America and Peru and what inflation did there. And he said basically the same thing you said. what we've been seeing has not been normal, in that there's an adjustment to more of a normal range of rates and inflation. But the other thing that comes out of what you just said, too, that I've found is there is something to be said for not reacting to every headline. You know, I mean, that's the other thing. And that's the danger. I mean, I've been doing this long enough, like you have. You know, you see what happens when the spiral down starts and the news starts and people all of a sudden, you know, what is that saying about making a long-term decision in the short term or something? You know, you react in the moment and you have long-term ramifications. And so there's something to be said for just sitting tight and being smart. Last thing I guess I want to ask you, actually two things. One is, you know, of all the different areas, I should have probably started with this, but how did you get into the fixed income arena of all the different things you could do, managing stocks or whatever? I mean, I'm just kind of curious because it's a bit of a unique niche, I think, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah, I actually started at Dean Witter and Morgan Stanley, and I was involved as being what they used to call Fed watchers. Money market economists was a term that was used back into the 90s. And I found it interesting because I would literally work with or on the trading floor, fixed income trading floor. And I found it very interesting because back to what I said before, when you're a fixed income strategist, you're looking at things from a broad perspective. So many things we've covered just in this 30 or 45 minutes that we've been speaking here, right? Impacts the bond market. So it all like comes together. You look at the economic numbers, the politics, what's going on geopolitical, things along those lines. They all play a role here in how the bond market and interest rates are developed as you go forward. So for me, I thought it was interesting. It was a way of, you can look at the past to kind of analyze what's happened historically. But then again, you also have to look at what's going on in the present and what could happen in the future for a whole variety of things that are, to what you said, in the headlines or could make headlines going forward. So that was one of the reasons why I think I enjoyed the bond market so much and just seeing it take place firsthand on a trading floor and seeing how traders and how money was being moved in the bond market and why? What was the impact? And every time you think you got it right, something happens and you get it wrong. So here I am 30 years later, still learning on the job.
You know, I got to tell you, I just appreciate people that have passion for what they do. It's just, it's exciting to just see, you know, like you said, a person that doesn't really know could just look, oh, you know, government bonds, you know, whatever. But I get what you're saying and the experiences and the things you learn over the years. And it is a case of the longer I go, the less I know kind of a thing for sure. So people, I know you do. I mentioned in the introduction, you put out a great Basis Points, your podcast. You know, it's a little 4 to 5 minute snippet of just timely points that are very easily explained. That's another thing I appreciate about you, Kevin, is you speak in English. You know, a lot of times people get lost in all this stuff. I can surrender to that myself sometimes. But in addition to your podcast, people want to get a hold of you and follow you. What's the best way to do that?
Well, like you said, I mean, there's the podcast. You can go on wisdomtree.com and look at some of the blogs that I write. Also being involved and author with our various Outlook pieces, a weekly Mind on the Markets commentary that I write with a colleague of mine, Jeff Weniger. So that's what I would say. Go to our website, www.wisdomtree.com. And you can pretty much find everything, including the podcast there.
Awesome. Listen, I appreciate the time. I know these are busy days for guys like you, but I just appreciate the time and the commentary and just want to thank you for joining me today on Upthinking Finance.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Emerson Fersh is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisor services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor and separate entity from Capital Investment Advisors. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. The guest speakers and the companies they represent are not affiliated with or endorsed by LPL Financial or Capital Investment Advisors. Individual tax and legal matters should be discussed with your tax or legal expert. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. There is no assurance that the techniques and strategies discussed are suitable for all investors or will yield positive outcomes. The purchase of certain securities may be required
to affect some of the strategies. Investing involves risks, including possible loss of principal.